Good evening. My name is Jamie. I'm an alcoholic. That was a little faster than I was expecting, but I guess that's good. So my sobriety date is March 23rd of 2002, and my home group is the Midtown Group in Bethesda, Maryland, and I have a sponsor. Her name is Susan D. I think she's been here before, too, and I'm really grateful to be here tonight. Thank you for asking me to come. It's always been a pleasure to visit your group, and I've been out here a few times. Quite a few of my friends have spoken out here, and I've been to a day conference, and it's always been nice. You know, it's always nice to have kind of a home away from home to visit, you know, with, you know, I feel like we're kind of one big family, and wherever I go, you know, to have a meeting to go to and feel at home and to be welcomed, it's just a nice thing. It's certainly a far cry from, you know, the way things were before I got here. So, I'm supposed to share with you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And let's see, I guess I'll just start at the beginning. I'm a person who grew up in an alcoholic home. And I don't say that because I think it's any sort of excuse for my alcoholism or any reason that I turned out the way that I am. The way I see it is really, if anything, I had the best examples of what not to do and how not to be, and yet the, you know, the insanity of my alcoholism is that I turn out exactly the same way. You know, I grew up in a household with, you know, a father that was a very heavy drinker, and, you know, there's lots of unpredictability and the things that come along with growing up in that environment. Now, I didn't know what alcoholic meant. I knew that my dad drank a lot of beer, and he acted like a different person when he was drinking. It made things in the house, you know, hostile sometimes. Sometimes, you know, we were that family on the block that, you know, other kids weren't allowed to come play at our house, or, you know, the cops were there on a regular basis, and, you know, the neighbors complained about us. We were, you know, we were that family. If you had that family in your neighborhood, that was us. And so I definitely knew something was different, and I guess I identified my circumstances with something being wrong with me, you know. My family was a little different than my friends' families, and, you know, I always felt embarrassed to have my friends over because I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know if my dad was going to come home drunk or, you know, if my parents were going to be fighting, and so I just, you know, I started kind of trying to act and be like something that I wasn't. My drink. Oh, sorry, never mind. I'm a little scratchy tonight, excuse me. But anyway, you know, I definitely knew something was different, and I guess because of that I thought something was different about me. But regardless of that, you know, I did have loving parents. You know, despite that, I was provided everything that I would need. You know, I had a home, I had clothes, I had food, I got to participate in things I wanted to do. I took dance classes from the time I was 3 years old. And, you know, my parents made sure that I never didn't have what I needed. And I often had what I wanted. So I definitely was not deprived. And my parents certainly loved me, you know, with whatever was going on with them. They were good parents and good people. And I can definitely see that today, although that's not how I felt at the time. And, you know, and also, I have an older brother who's 2 years older than me that grew up in the same environment. And, you know, like myself, as a teenager, experimented with drinking and had fun and went out and, you know, partied and things. But unlike me, he was able to show up for life and function and has turned into a totally productive member of society. His drinking has never affected his development as a human being, as an adult. You know, he has a family and a career and a home that he's bought and he pays for on time, and he has more than one vehicle. You know, he has always had good relationships with the family. He hasn't had to lie, cheat, and steal to get by. And he grew up in the same household that I did. So obviously, if those circumstances make a person alcoholic, then, you know, that just can't be true. And I know that today because I also have met people from all different backgrounds and circumstances that could be in Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, people with totally normal, whatever that means, parents, non-drinking, non-alcoholic household, turned out alcoholic just like me. So as far as I'm concerned, the problem is something within me. And it just was easier to blame my circumstances and my environment, you know, before I ever had some sort of solution to help me see that I was the problem and that I was the one that was sick. But so anyway, I grew up with these examples, not just my dad. We had a lot of drinkers, a lot of loud, fighting, angry Irish drinkers on my dad's side of the family, and so much so that we had to stop congregating on holidays because someone was going to punch someone, someone was going to knock over the Christmas tree and spill water all over the presents, you know, somebody was going to curse out grandma. Like, you never knew what was going to happen, so it just seemed better not to congregate. We all just decided not to get together on that side of the family, and I grew up with, like I said, the things that I needed, the things that I wanted, but also this sense that I was different than other people. And, like I said, I had the circumstances of my growing up, I thought, made me different. I had a speech impediment. I wore hand-me-down clothes. I had to go to speech therapy. And, you know, I thought these things made me awkward or different. But really, I think every kid has something like that, you know. And those just happen to be my things. But for someone like me, you know, who has been spiritually sick from the time I think I was born, I don't know if I could say I was born alcoholic, because I think you have to drink to be an alcoholic. But I do think something's always been off with me, and I didn't really have some way to define that until I discovered alcohol and discovered my problems with drinking. But you know, I kind of had this idea that drinking was bad, and, you know, I learned those things in school, you know, that you shouldn't drink, you shouldn't do drugs, and I really wanted to be a good kid, you know. Unlike, you know, it seems like most people that I meet in AA go one of two ways. It's either the way of, you know, trying to overachieve or the way of trying to underachieve. And really it's all, I think, the same goal in trying to find some way to feel whole, you know, and to fix yourself. And for me, I was the kind of kid that wanted to get straight A's and have every teacher like me and impress my parents and, like, do a good job, because I thought maybe if I was perfect at everything, then I'd feel better about myself. But, you know, I didn't get straight A's. I got good grades, though, and I wasn't always, you know, the best kid, I certainly wasn't the most popular. I was, you know, so self-centered, I didn't really have many friends, and because I just didn't know how to relate to other people. I was so obsessed with thinking about what you were thinking about me that I couldn't even carry on a conversation. And so really, it wasn't until I got into high school that things started to change for me. I kind of made this internal decision. I remember talking to one of my little girlfriends when we were getting ready to enter high school, and I was like, things are going to change. I'm going to reinvent myself. I want to be popular. I want to be a part of, you know, I wanted to be a part of life. I just felt like I was always, like, looking in the window at everybody else, you know, having a good time and hanging out together. And there's no reason I couldn't be a part of that. It was just me that kept me from being a part of life and whatever was wrong with me, which I had no idea at the time. And I really hadn't even started drinking, but I kind of made this decision that that was going to stop and that I was going to do whatever I had to do to be, you know, to become a part of life, you know, be one among many. And, you know, but I still had this idea. I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to be like my father and my uncles. And, you know, I thought those things were bad. And I had values and convictions and things that were instilled in me by my parents about what was right and wrong. I had no, it wasn't like I wasn't taught those things and I didn't have some sense of what was right and wrong. But the first opportunity that I was offered alcohol was the beginning of starting to compromise those convictions and things like that. And, you know, like I said, I have an older brother who was pretty much everything I was not with ease, you know. He was popular. He was athletic. He, you know, the guys liked him. The girls loved him. I mean, you know, all my little girlfriends had a crush on him always. And, you know, he did good in school. He did great at sports. And, you know, he just was kind of an average good kid, you know. And my parents at this point had separated. My mom was out of town this weekend, and my brother decided to throw a party. And we grew up in Baltimore County, kind of right outside of the city, pretty small town, the kind of place where if you invite 10 people to a party, your whole high school shows up. And maybe even some people that don't even go to your high school, but pretty much everybody in town. And quickly this little get-together my brother planned turned into, you know, like the party of the year at that time, you know, and so many people showed up. And in my self-centeredness, I could not handle being around all these people that I, you know, I looked up to, I wanted to be friends with, but felt like I didn't know how to talk to or relate to. And so, you know, I just went in my room and had a panic attack. I didn't even know, I couldn't even be with these people, you know. They were drinking and partying, and I was still afraid of those things, you know. I was like, we're going to get in trouble. Oh, my gosh, you know, what if the cops show up? What if our mom finds out, you know? But what happened was some of my brother's friends came upstairs and said, come downstairs. Come join the party. Come on. We'll help you, you know, feel more comfortable. And, you know, as amateurs tend to do, some drink was concocted of every liquor that was brought to the party, ended up looking something like tar, and it was handed to me in a little Dixie cup, you know, real classy, and I, you know, I was told to drink it. I knew it was alcohol, and I knew that that's something I said I didn't want to do, but I looked around the room, and I saw everybody else was drinking, and everybody else looked the way I wanted so desperately to feel on the inside. And at that moment, I thought, maybe if I do what they do, I can feel how they look like they feel, you know? And so, you know, that, like I said, was kind of the beginning of my tossing my convictions and ideas of right and wrong out the window. And I was just, I think I had just turned 14 at this time. And so I drank that, you know, disgusting concoction. And pretty instantly, you know, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, it was a bunch of hard liquor. It didn't take much. I couldn't wait anything, and of course I didn't have any sort of tolerance, so after I drank that drink down, I had an effect, you know. And for me, it was, you know, my sponsor talks about alcohol, how it was to her like a magical potion, and to me it was the same way. Like, I literally felt like someone sprinkled fairy dust on me. And and just the fact alone, if you don't hear any other proof in my story, there's something abnormal about my reaction to alcohol. I know today that everybody doesn't react the way I did that night, and but at the time I didn't know it was anything different. I thought I finally figured out what this drinking thing was all about, and this is why people do it, because this like wave of like warmth and happiness just rushed over my body. I felt like I had been walking around my whole life with my shoulders and my ears. I didn't even know how tense and uncomfortable I was. It was just the state I had always lived in. I didn't know any different until something gave me relief, and drinking gave me relief, and I just remember feeling so comfortable and relieved, and I finally felt like I could be among these people. Maybe I could be friends with the popular kids. Maybe I could go to these parties and be a part of, and do all those things I want to do, and you know, and so I was pretty excited, you know, but as I did from this point till the time I got sober, you know, I drank alcoholically from the very beginning, you know. It took me a while to cross that line, you know. It's not like I, you know, went out and sold all my possessions the first night I drank and and destroyed my life in one evening, but I certainly set out on a path of self-destruction. And, you know, I immediately thought, if one drink makes you feel this good, I'm sure that two will feel even better. And three, I mean, forget about it, you know. So I drank that night until I couldn't get my hands on another drop of alcohol. You know, it was the middle of the night, and the party is ending, and people are going home, and some people are passed out. Thank you. And I'm ready to go. I'm like, what's happening? Why are you leaving? The party's just starting. It's like 4 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, I'm jumping on the bed. And, you know, somebody gave me another substance. I didn't even ask what it was, and I took it, and I was having the effects of that. You know, and this is all the first night that I drank. And, you know, but, you know, all in all, there, you know, I said and did some things that were embarrassing, and which was to become a trend. But you know, that wasn't really, you know, the next morning, and I was someone that had hangovers every time I drank. I envy people still today that talk about never having hangovers. I don't even understand that. And there's something wrong with the fact that I envy that, but, you know, like, how come you got to drink so much without, but for me, it was a small price to pay, you know. I had, you know, I was a puker, I was a, you know, passer outer, blacker outer, everything, and all the bad side effects you can have from drinking, I had from day one, but really, it was no big deal, you know. Those consequences were not a big deal because I finally felt like I was living. And so, you know, as any good alcoholic, I pursued as many opportunities to drink as I could. And as a young person, I didn't have the opportunity. I could just go to the liquor store the next day. And I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't, you know, I just knew I wanted more of that feeling that I had when I was drinking. And so for the next 4 years, I set out to drink as much and as often as I could. But I still had, you know, it talks about in our literature, you know, kind of crossing this invisible line. And I hadn't crossed that line yet. You know, I spent the first few years of my drinking with really few consequences. I still had some control over, you know, I didn't have to drink every single day. I didn't have to give up everything in my life right away. You know, and almost it really made me cocky is what happened because I still showed up for school. I still did pretty good in my classes. At this time, I started getting involved in lots of activities in schools and the marching band and theater and student government and Students Against Drunk Driving. I signed the prom promise, you know, and I mean, I still tried to keep up this image on the outside. And it's also like it talks about in the book how most alcoholics lead a double life. And I prided myself in my double life. I had, you know, this life of this seeming good little girl who did her homework and the teachers thought was a nice girl and then, you know, went to marching band practice and helped decorate for the homecoming dance and all these things. And had these good little friends in school that did all that stuff, too. And then on Friday, I went to hang out with the dark side, you know. And I totally switched, you know, my image. And I, you know, the people I associated with totally different people. When I was outside of school, I did not associate with those people inside of school. Because I picked up quickly who was drinking the way I was drinking and who was not. And I had no problem being your friend, you know, during, you know, Monday through Friday until 3:30 in the afternoon. But after that, I didn't have any need for you. And, you know, I went off to find my lower companions or be someone's lower companion, I guess. And, you know, I hung out with lots of older kids, people that didn't go to my school, people that were old enough to buy alcohol. And, you know, I found my ways to drink. And, you know, really all seemed well for a while. You know, I kind of got away with this double life for a while. And like I said, I got pretty cocky and I thought I had a pretty good deal. But somewhere in those first few years, I started to cross that line. You know, and I didn't say this in the beginning, but especially if you're new tonight, everything I share in my story are things that I have only seen in hindsight. I didn't see any of this as it was happening. This was just life. As I lived it, I didn't think once about what I was doing or why, you know, is there something wrong with my drinking? Is there, you know, am I doing anything different than other people? I didn't think about any of those things. I just kind of rolled through life blindly, you know, not looking in any direction but, you know, at what I wanted to look at, really, and not even what was in front of me half the time. And, but, I went ahead and, you know, kept drinking, but eventually, you know, I wanted to drink more, and I wanted to find more opportunities, and with that, I had to make some sacrifices. You know, I couldn't always make it to those after-school practices because I knew there were other kids drinking, and I couldn't make it to school on time in the morning because I'd have my mom drop me off at my friend's house so we could drink or do other things before school, and, you know, those weekend parties started to bleed into the week, and sometimes they started on Thursday, and sometimes they ran over till Monday, and, you know, it's hard to show up for class at, 7:30 in the morning and things like that when you've been drinking all weekend and haven't been sleeping and things like that. So I started to have some consequences, and I wasn't able to uphold that image as much as I was in the beginning, and, you know, teachers and my parents started to see that something was changing, something was wrong, and you know, and ask me questions and try to help me. And nobody ever addressed my drinking, you know, because I was, you know, unfortunately at the time, but unfortunately now I still have a very I'm very good at being, you know, deceptive, and I'm very good at hiding things and being sneaky and getting away with things and telling people what they want to hear and seeming sincere. And, you know, and the adults in my life really wanted to believe those things and really wanted to help me. And so, you know, I played the part, I played the game, and I did what I had to do to keep them from finding out about my drinking. You know, I protected that because what I got from that was like nothing else in my life. And I would have given up anything else that I cared about prior to drinking in a heartbeat. It wasn't taken from me. My drinking didn't rob me of anything. I freely gave those things away for an opportunity to drink. And so really by the time I graduated high school, I had, you know, I was barely passing. I did so well in the beginning and got in all these good classes, and then I stopped showing up. I couldn't do well in those classes. I started getting kicked out of some of those clubs, and really, I just barely graduated by the skin of my teeth. I don't really know how I did it. You know, if I hadn't done so well in the beginning, I probably wouldn't have gotten through it. Certainly, there's no virtue of my own that I graduated high school, but, you know, all my friends were deciding, you know, am I going to go to college or a trade school or start a career, and I really, honestly, I thought they were a bunch of suckers, because I thought, what a waste of time. Like, why would you go to college when everybody knows all you do at college is drink and party? You're just going to waste somebody else's money and come back home to live in your parents' basement again. So you might as well forget about all that. Like, I really thought the way I was thinking was so logical and made so much sense. And so I decided not to do that. I didn't even bother, you know. I was even offered a scholarship from my high school, you know, just because of the activities I was in without even trying, and I didn't use it because I didn't go to college. But I decided, you know, at this point that I came up with a plan, and if you've ever had an alcoholic plan, you know what I'm talking about, you know, and mine was, I'm going to take a year off, you know, I'm just going to, now that I don't have to go to school, I can really just, like, party the way I want to and drink the way I want without any restrictions or having to be anywhere. So I'm just going to party hard and drink hard and get it out of my system. You know, in a year from now, maybe I'll think about going to college. So I did have aspirations. It's not like I didn't want to do anything. I had dreams and things I wanted to do and something I wanted to be. But that was eclipsed by what I was given by alcohol. You know, there was no way that was ever going to be more powerful than what drinking was to me. So I, you know, I set out on my one-year plan, which turned in a lot longer than 1 year. But what happened was in those next 3 years, my drinking really took off, and I definitely crossed that line, like I was talking about, where, you know, looking back, and again, at the time I didn't know this, but looking back, I can see that I no longer had control over my drinking. I didn't have the ability to choose whether or not I was going to drink, if I was going to let my drinking affect other areas of my life, and it certainly did. You know, I went out and got a job and started to make some money so I could support my drinking. That was really the only reason I got a job, because I had no other way to get money to drink, so I had to get a job. And it wasn't because I wanted to be a productive member of society or anything like that. But, you know, so I started off in this pattern of getting jobs and showing up for the first few days early, doing a stellar job, you know, impressing them, putting on the act, putting on the show. And, you know, and then once I got comfortable a week in or 2 weeks in, I start showing up late, and then I start calling out sick. And it's not because I was sick, it's because I was hungover. It's because I was partying all night and I couldn't show up. And then eventually, sometimes my judgment would be impaired and I would start, you know, stealing things from my work because I would blow through my paycheck on the weekend and I didn't have any way to get alcohol for the next 2 weeks. So I started to get desperate and I started to make a lot of really bad choices. And so I would lose that job, and I would get another one, and the cycle would start over. And, you know, when I got sober, I didn't even, you know, at the time I didn't see the insanity of the way I was living, but the 3 years from after high school, I had anywhere from, like, 10 to 15 jobs each of those years. And that can be a new job every few weeks if you do the math. And there's absolutely nothing manageable about that. But in my mind, the way I justified it was, at least I always have a job. You know, it might be different tomorrow, but at least I always have a job. And you know, during this time, I met my spiritual, you know, twin, who was to become my boyfriend, and, you know, we were to proceed killing ourselves together. And really, because by this time, even, you know, those friends I partied with in high school, like, even most of those people started to grow up and move on with their lives and go to college and have careers and become parents and, you know, get married and do grown-up things. And they might have continued to drink, but, you know, where they kind of, you know, started to slow down and continue to develop as a person, I continued to develop in my drinking, and there was no room for me in their lives, and there was no room for them in mine, so I continued to seek out, you know, other people that were living the way that I was living, because as long as I was around other people drinking the way I was, there was nothing wrong with my drinking. And so I, you know, met this man, and we started drinking together, and, you know, I was introduced to a lot of other, you know, things, a lot of other substances and activities that really ultimately brought me, or what brought me to my knees. And I only want to share this because it is a, it's a big part of what has helped me realize that I'm alcoholic, you know. I don't think that I need to get into the details of the other things I did besides drinking, except to say that, you know, during these few years, my activities included a lot of drugs and a lot of illegal activities and, you know, behaviors and things that, I really, every once in a while, I would get, have these moments of thinking, this is like a bad after-school special, and I know my parents didn't raise me to be this kind of girl, and, you know, lying to people, cheating, stealing, you know, because of my unmanageability with jobs and money, you know, I started writing bad checks, and, you know, that started to catch up to me legally, and I started having, you know, getting desperate, because I wasn't, you know, I had, my tolerance was higher, I was drinking more, and in order to support my habit, I had to do things like, you know, lie to my grandmother so she would give me money, when really I was going to drink, or, you know, steal what few possessions of value my mother had, suck upon them for money for drugs, and, you know, got to the point where my older brother felt so uncomfortable with me in the house, he put a lock on his bedroom door that he could only get into with a key. And I still took his door off the hinges to take his television and put it back on the hinges. And I thought that I was really clever, you know. But I just caused everyone terror and fear, and had become that same, you know, crazy, unpredictable alcoholic that I had grown up under, thinking I will never be that way. And you know, so I had alienated my family, obviously. When you're living that way, you know, you're certainly, you know, it got to the point where my family, you know, never stopped loving me or caring for me and trying to help me, but it just got to the point where they couldn't watch me kill myself, and they couldn't see what I was doing, and they would politely ask me, you know, not to come around, and, you know, and not to, they certainly didn't want me in their houses when they weren't around, and I had just burned all the bridges back to, you know, safety that I had, And I just commiserated with this, you know, this companion of mine until eventually, you know, he was someone who got in a lot of trouble with the law, and that, a lot of stuff caught up to him, and he went away for what's going to be a while, and I found myself completely alone, you know. And as long as I had someone, you know, to commiserate with, someone to drink with, someone to hide behind, I didn't really think, you know, I could tell myself whatever I wanted, and I would believe it. But, I finally found myself completely alone. I had no friends. The only people I would have called friends at the time were people that would buy me alcohol or sell me drugs, or that, you know, I had something you wanted, you had something I wanted, and we would still rip each other off when nobody was looking. You know, I've heard people, you know, call them frenemies, you know, friends of convenience, you know, not really, not the kind of friendships that I know today sober, But that was, you know, that was just the way my life had become. Everything and anything I did was in order to get my next drink. And it was at whatever price it was going to be, you know, whether it was, you know, valuables, whether it was relationships, the peace of mind of the people that loved me. I was willing to sacrifice it all, because that is how powerful alcohol was to me and for me. So, you know, once this, you know, boyfriend went away and I was kind of alone, you know, I got scared. I really didn't have any friendly direction to turn, and I wanted, I didn't have any intention of stopping drinking or anything like that. It still was working for me. Alcohol never stopped doing for me what it had done for me in the beginning. If it had, I would have had an easier time stopping drinking. But I knew I was kind of stuck, you know, and I had spent periods of time, you know, living in motels and sleeping in cars and things like that by choice, because I could have gone home. My family would have helped me. They would have let me in their house under the condition I wouldn't be drinking the way I was drinking, and that just wasn't an option. So I chose to be homeless. I chose to live in a motel. You know, I chose to, you know, steal from strangers and things like that so I could get a drink. But I ended up at this time being kind of scared, and by now my father had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought that was really great for him because he really had a drinking problem. And if you knew my dad, you would know that he needed to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, again, it's, you know, I had no intentions of getting sober, but I really just wanted a safe place to stay. You know, I didn't feel safe anymore. I had, you know, nowhere to go, and I knew if I asked for help that my dad would let me come live with him, have somewhere to sleep, give me food, and that was about it. That's really all I cared about. And so I moved in with my dad, and he had some conditions, you know, that I had to go to treatment, and that I was going to get sober, basically. You know, he took me to meetings, he introduced me to all the people he knew in the fellowship, and he had great friends and a great sponsor, and people really reached out to me, but I did not think that this was my problem. I didn't think it was for me. You know, I certainly could see at this point that, you know, I definitely, you know, got in some trouble with drugs and some of the activities I was involved in and the guy that I was involved in and some of the people I was running around with. And maybe if I got rid of those things, I could get back to the business of drinking the way other people drank. Because I still had this idea that drinking's not that bad. Like, it's not even illegal. Now, I wasn't even legally able to drink at this time. That's how delusional I was. But I thought, it's, you know, everybody drinks. Like, there's got to be some way that I can drink like other people. Now, I didn't even read the Big Book at that time, and it was amazing to me when I read that and heard that, you know, that is like the great obsession of every alcoholic, you know, and I had that. You know, maybe if I change some of my circumstances, if I get things, okay, I'm going to get rid of these things, I'll do all this, but I'm not giving up my drinking, you know, and so I did those things, and it wasn't easy, but, you know, I got rid of the drugs. I cut off contact with the boyfriend in jail. I moved out of the area where I ran around with all the people I was drinking and partying with. I totally detached myself from that lifestyle. I moved back in with my family. I went to treatment. Things were looking okay. But, you know, the one thing I didn't know was the power of alcoholism, and that what I didn't know is that I had lost the power to choose whether or not I was going to drink. And so, you know, I went to an outpatient treatment program, and I strolled in there pretty arrogantly thinking, you know, I know about Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad's sober. I've been to a few meetings. I've been to his celebration. You know, he took me to some AA events. And really, you know, I can see now he was planting the seed, you know, and there were people saving a seat for me in Alcoholics Anonymous years before I got here. And but they also knew I wasn't ready and that they weren't going to be able to get me to do anything until I had hit a bottom sufficient enough for me to surrender. And so, you know, I had been exposed to AA. I thought I knew what it was all about. I heard what you people said, and, you know, I got it, okay. And so I played the part, you know, and I strutted in there knowing far more than everybody else. I told everybody else what they needed to do to stay sober, and then I proceeded to go out and get drunk. And for the next 9 months is really where I kind of discovered my powerlessness. Because I thought I had gotten rid of all the, you know, all the biggest vices in my life, all the bad things, all the things that were causing, you know, it's like I got rid of all these things that were destroying my life. So why is it that I want to die more than I ever have? You know, why is it that I'm more desperate and miserable? And why is it that I can't stop drinking? And I really, for me, I know everyone doesn't have this experience, I really did try to stop drinking. I thought that if I could stop for a period of time, I could go back to drinking. But even for that period of time, I was incapable. I would stay sober for a few weeks. I would pick up a 30-day chip, and I would drink. I would pick up a 60-day chip. That was about my limit. I think it was about 60 days that I could hold my breath. And mind you, this is not working a program or having, you know, a sponsor or steps. I barely stayed inside the meeting. You know, I was one of those people that came in, got a seat, and then went out to smoke for 45 minutes, and then came back to say the prayer. And might have came back in to go to the bathroom and go back out to smoke some more and come back in to say the prayer or not come back in to say the prayer. You know, I had that parking lot sobriety. And people suggested to get a sponsor. I said, I already have two parents. Thank you very much. I don't need someone else to tell me what to do. I'm a grown woman who acted like a total child and was not mentally, emotionally, you know, grown up in any sort of way. But I certainly, you know, still had some arrogance about me. But those last few months, I really was kind of beaten into submission by my alcoholism. And, you know, with all those other things stripped away, you know, changing all my outside circumstances and doing everything I could to try to better my situation, I still could not stop drinking. And, you know, I would go to visit old friends. I mean, like all the classic things you hear people share, you know, the things that bring people back to drinking. I mean, I was never really sober. It's not like I relapsed. I was never really sober. I was just hanging around AA. I hadn't gotten this thing yet in the least bit. But I was exposed, you know, and the seed was planted, and I just needed a little more time to hit my bottom. And what happened to me before getting sober this time was really nothing spectacular, you know. But I know today this is, you know, the moment where really the grace of my loving higher power stepped in, because, you know, obviously I couldn't stay sober. I was living with my dad and his two sober roommates, and because it was a detriment to their sobriety that I kept drinking, they had to kick me out. And I was so angry, and I didn't understand, like, aren't you supposed to help me? I'm trying to get sober. I really wasn't trying, and they knew that I wasn't ready and that they couldn't save me, and they had to let me go. And that was one of the best things they could have done for me. I had one other family member, my mom's sister, who was always kind of like a big sister to me, who took me in. But, you know, I had a lot of strict rules and regulations, and I felt like a prisoner, and, you know, I really felt, you know, like, you know, I couldn't be in the house when they weren't there. And, you know, they made me go get a job and start paying off all these debts and bad checks and ran up credit cards and all these, you know, bad choices I had made. And really, they tried to help me get my life together. And you know, so I was living with them, and they would go to bed at night, and I would sneak downstairs and pour myself a tumbler full of whatever was in their liquor cabinet, stand over the sink and pinch my nose and chug it. It was like I had a bad cold, and I had to get the medicine in me. And it's like it wasn't even about, like, the party was over. Everything that was exciting about drinking was gone. It was just, like, to breathe. It was just to survive. I didn't have to like it. It didn't have to taste good. It didn't have to be cold. I didn't have to be with friends. I just needed to get it in me so I could go on for just a little bit longer. And I did this for a while until, you know, I don't know what it was different about this day, but I woke up one day and sleeping on the air mattress in the corner of my aunt and uncle's workout room, and they had this one wall that was all mirrors, and I kind of picked my head up and I saw my face in the mirror, and I just, you know, had that moment that I know now is described in this big book as the jumping off place. But I just thought, I can't go on living like this. But I cannot stop drinking, and I'm screwed, you know. I felt completely desperate and absolutely at my wit's end, because I had tried everything in my human power, and it had all failed me. And the only solution I could come up with is that I was probably just going to have to kill myself, put myself out of my misery, stop, you know, hurting everybody that loved me. I had made a mess of my life, and I was obviously not going to be able to save it, and it's probably best for everyone involved that I'm just out of this world. And after that, I had this relief that was like, finally, this is all going to be over. And then right after that, I was terrified, because I realized it wasn't dramatic. I wasn't going to tell anybody. I knew I was going to do it, and I knew I needed help. And people have been telling me I needed help. I had been introduced to the help. I've been hanging around the help. I've been smoking in the parking lot of the help for a while. Do you know what I'm saying? But until I recognized myself that I had a problem, until I realized that I needed help, none of that meant anything to me. All it was just, like I said, planting the seed. And so, you know, I called up a friend that I met in that treatment program and had taken me to this one young people's meeting 2 months prior that I really liked. You know, this woman had shared, and I loved what she said. I related, and it really kind of scared me, you know. I wasn't ready to go there. I just wasn't ready. And people wanted my phone number and asked if I had a sponsor, and what I was doing the next day, and I was like, whoa, 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 back it up. That's a bit too much. I don't even know you. No, I'm not going to give you my phone number. You know, it was, like, way too much for me. I just hadn't surrendered. I needed a little more proof, and, you know, 2 months later, I guess I had had all the proof that I needed. And so I called that friend. I said, I want to go back to those meetings with you. And, you know, I lived a good hour away from where this meeting was. I didn't drive, you know, but this guy came and picked me up and took me to this meeting, which is now my home group. And, you know, I met a woman there who was to become my sponsor. And still, you know, my ego and my arrogance, you know, wouldn't allow me to go up and ask someone to be my sponsor when people told me that's what I needed to do. And thankfully for me, somebody told me they were going to be my sponsor. And that's what I needed, because even in the beaten state that I was in, I was not going to ask for help. And I was way too prideful. I could not let you know how much I was hurting. And so, but this woman offered to be my sponsor. And for the first 3 months I was here, she did some really great things for me. You know, she introduced me to fellowship. Everywhere she went, she took me with her. Her friends became my friends. She, you know, introduced me to new things. She helped me laugh a little bit. She helped me start to take care of myself physically. And she had about 7 years sober. And then by, you know, after 3 months, I really didn't get to know her very well, but somehow she came to the conclusion that she didn't think she was alcoholic, and she left, and that really startled me, because I didn't know, you know, I had had my own experience, but I didn't think I was ever really sober, and I don't really think I was prior to that point. I think I was just hanging around AA, but this woman had 7 years sober. That's like a lifetime, and I was really shaken by that, because I thought once you came here, you were safe. Like, how is it that she's drinking? I just didn't understand. And, you know, but people told me, you know, that we don't all get to stay here, and that, you know, some people don't make it, and there's a lot of reasons for that, but that what I needed to do was to get another sponsor and keep moving forward. And in that period of time, there was this woman who was always around, and every time I saw her, she said hi to me. She always smiled. She took the time to ask me how I was doing. And a lot of people did that. It's not like she was the only one, but I had this feeling like she really cared about me. And she really took an interest, and I don't know what it was, but it's just like, especially being a woman, the kind of relationships I had with women prior to that, it was so foreign to me, have a woman be so kind and have no strings attached, not trying to steal my boyfriend, not trying to take money out of my purse, me not trying to do the same thing to her, you know. She was just being nice for the sake of being nice, and took the time to make me feel welcome here, and took a real interest in me. And when I knew I needed to get another sponsor, I knew that woman was going to be the woman I was going to ask. And thank God for her, because she really has saved me. She has been, you know, one of the best examples of AA, and the best sponsor I could possibly have, you know. And I really hope that you feel that way about your sponsor, you know. We come from completely different ends of the earth. Like, our experience, our upbringings are totally opposite. You know, we have lots of different experience. We have lots of similar experience, you know. But the thing we have in common is that thing that really all of us have, is that language of the heart, you know. And I related to the way, I remember when I knew I was going to ask her to be my sponsor, we were sitting in this meeting. She was way in the front, and I was way in the back. And she was telling this story, this horrible story about something that happened when she was drinking that was degrading and humiliating. And then everybody burst into laughter, and she started laughing. And I couldn't understand that, because things like that had happened to me, and I thought, I did not think it was funny. But I wasn't angry. I was curious. I thought, how is it that you can be so free of that? Like, how can you not still define yourself by those things that happened in your past? And whatever that was, I wanted some of that. You know, I thought, whatever that is, I want that. I want to get there. And so I asked her that night to be my sponsor. And, you know, and she really got me into the program, you know. That previous sponsor did so much for me in introducing me to the fellowship and the activities and things we do in AA. But this sponsor opened up the big book and said, you know, let's read the steps. Let's write your fourth step. And this day we're going to do your fifth step. And then later on we're going to write your eighth step, and you're going to start doing your ninth step amends. And throughout the whole time, and still today, she has always shared her experience with me. You know, wherever I'm at, she shares with me when she was at that place, or if she's at that place, what it was like for her and what she's done to get through that. And when I go through things she doesn't have experience with, she shows me, she introduces me to other people that I can talk to for help. And really, you know, all was well for a while. You know, I did, you know, I really got hooked in here. I got friends pretty quickly. My health got better pretty quickly. I got a job I was able to show up at and keep pretty quickly. And I was taught all these things by you guys, you know, by following the examples of people in AA. And really just by being, you know, surrendered and being willing to try something outside of my own ideas, my life got really good pretty quickly, you know. But what happened was I also got into a relationship pretty quickly. And this is just my experience, and this is what, you know, what has taught me a lot of lessons in sobriety is that, you know, I got a lot of things to look the way I wanted them to look on the outside pretty early on in sobriety. And I started to rest a lot of my comfort and reliance in those things. And really, once I kind of got introduced to the steps and started to go through them with my sponsor and took a few actions, I started to coast on those actions and hide behind these things that made me comfortable, you know, hide behind the boyfriend and the friends and the activities. And really, there wasn't a whole lot of growth happening on the inside, you know, continuing through the steps and getting interested in helping other people. Like, those things aren't really happening. I had this mentality like, I've wasted some time. I got some time to make up for. You know, I got to go back to school. I got to get some stuff. You know, I got to get married. I got to hurry up. All my friends are, you know, it's like I got to catch up with the rest of, you know, life. But the difference between everybody else I went to high school with and all those other people I compare myself to is that none of them are alcoholic. And what I didn't know is that I had to keep growing spiritually. I had to keep seeking the solution every day in the same way I saw a drink every day as a solution. Because if I didn't, I was going to find something to replace that. You know, and it was happening to people all around me. It happens all the time, and we see it every day. But I had developed this idea, this mentality, like I said when that first sponsor left, that I was safe. Like, I crossed this invisible line. Like, I crossed home plate, and I was safe. I got a home run. I'm sober. I'm all right now, right? We're cool? Okay. But, you know, like I said, I failed to enlarge my spiritual life. And I was able to coast on those things. And obviously, you know, one thing that my sponsor helped me see when my house of cards fell down was that obviously I learned something here. And there's something to be said for going to a meeting every day, doing service, participating in the fellowship. Those things obviously have value, because if I wasn't at least doing that, I might not be sober today. And all those things were great, and all those things, I learned a lot. I learned how to go back out there in society and start to function like other people. You know, I'm still not like other people mentally and emotionally, but I could start to show up for life, be a part of my family again, you know, and really mend the past. But ultimately, I wasn't continuing to grow and get better on the inside. And because of that, you know, I personally started to revert back into lots of old behaviors, being destructive, being harmful in relationships, being unmanageable in finances and other, you know, dropping the ball, you know, doing all this work and then not following through, not being consistent. And eventually, really, I mean, I hate to say it, but really the thing that happened was for me is that relationship ended, and everything that I had built my security on and all my comfort was gone. And all that, you know, that was at about 3.5 years sober. And my sponsor used to say to me, your life is like a house of cards. And I was like, what does that mean? That's, you know, my sponsor, I love her so much. She says a lot of silly things that I don't think make sense at the time. Until my house of cards fell down, I had no idea what she was talking about. I thought she was just being funny. But, you know, my foundation was not built on much anything solid. You know, it was built on all the wrong things. And when that happened, I did not think I was going to be able to stay sober. And I really felt like a newcomer all over again. Like, I really had to start over and find out again what this program was all about. And I did that. And for a time, things got better. And then I did it again, you know. I'm one of those especially stupid and stubborn. And I'm also one of those people that likes to practice insanity, you know, and try. I know it didn't work last time, But this time is a little bit different, and I think I'm going to try it one more time. And that's, you know, that's part of what, why I still need to be here, you know, and why I still have a lot to learn and a lot of growing to do. You know, I continue to do this a few times, you know, put my reliance in relationships and in outside things, and ultimately destroy those relationships and, you know, harm myself and harm other people in the process and act effectively. And really, then I got to a point at 4.5 years sober where, you know, that invisible line I thought I crossed, I found myself back and right back over it because I had behaved so poorly in Alcoholics Anonymous for those few years that I started to feel like I wasn't going to be able to be here anymore. And it wasn't that I was thinking about drinking. And that's where, to me, alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. It was, I just couldn't be with you guys anymore because you guys were the problem. My home group was the problem. This ex-boyfriend was the problem, or that ex-boyfriend was the problem, or the sponsor was the problem, and I just needed to change the scene. Maybe I need to move back to, you know, be with my family. I just need to get out of this place. You know, I started opening up back doors for myself, just in case I needed somewhere to go. And it wasn't drinking friends or anything like that. It was just, you know, deceitful behavior and things like that. And what ended up happening was, you know, one day I was at my office where I worked, and nobody else was there that day. And I worked for this doctor who always had a couple bottles of wine in the refrigerator. And I knew they were there. I worked there for a couple years. And I was aware of it because I'm an alcoholic, but for the most part, it didn't really bother me. You know, I had a healthy relationship with alcohol where I was not cocky or afraid. But on this day, you know, everything just kind of came to a head for me, and I realized that I had become so uncomfortable because of my lack of growth and progress, you know, just kind of standing still in AA, that all of a sudden I remembered that wine was there and that I was going to drink it, that my body was going to take me to it, and I was not going to have any control over what happened. And I think that's when I really came to my own understanding of my powerlessness and what alcoholism was all about. You know, I had been reading it in this book and talking about it with people for years, but that's when it became real to me. And you know, I'd like to say from that point on, it's all been uphill, but I've still had some lessons to learn. I've continued to make mistakes, but for some reason, by the grace of God, I'm still sober today, and obviously, a lot of things have gotten better. I would not still be here. And even for those experiences that I have had sober, not having to drink over those things, I have been able to grow, you know, through those experiences and become a better person and start to grow up and be an adult and start to take responsibility for my actions and maybe be an example to other people and help them to learn, you know, learn from my mistakes or help, you know, just learn from my own. And that has been something really valuable in me for being able to help other women. And that's something that has become more interesting to me. And that's really become the thing that has made me feel the most a part of here. And it's, you know, my favorite prayer is the St. Francis prayer because it's everything that I need to be reminded of on a daily basis. And it's the opposite of how I operate normally. Because, you know, I came here in the beginning, and I still come here most days to seek comfort. I come here so that you can make me feel better, so that somebody can come shake my hand and make me feel welcome and comfortable. But, you know, those and when that happens, I do. I feel better. I feel comfortable. But those things are really fleeting, you know. It's when I come here and I seek to offer you comfort and look for the person that is, his skin is crawling and they're sitting in the corner because they don't know who to talk to, you know, or I just take an interest in somebody, whether they look uncomfortable or not, to go up to someone and talk about them instead of me. It's then that I really feel a part of what's going on here. It's then that I feel useful, and I start to feel the promises that these steps offer us in this program. I mean, they're all throughout the book. You know, it offers us promises if we take these steps and we, you know, accept this program as our way of life, good things will happen, and you don't have to make them happen. They just will. And that has been my experience, you know. I know I share a lot about my struggles and things, but I really feel like it's important. It was important for me, and it is today, to hear people talk about how it's not easy to be sober. It's not easy to stay sober, and this is probably the hardest thing that I've ever had to do in my life. But it's also been the most valuable thing and it's been my saving grace. It's given me a life. I wouldn't even say it saved my life, because there was nothing worth saving in the life I had before I came here, you know? If I had gotten back everything I had before, I wouldn't want it, you know? I'd be selling it all again, you know? But I've been given opportunities to become far beyond the kind of person I would have hoped, you know, and have a life so much bigger and fuller than what my small mind could have imagined when I got here, you know, as far as the friendships that I have, that I've had for years, you know, the life experiences I've had with people in AA, being able to show up for people through, you know, weddings, funerals, babies being born, having people show up for me for the big things in my life, being able to go back to school and pursue a dream, you know, and, like, do something that I love, and now having that be my career, you know, like, that's not, I really thought I had given up all my opportunities to do things like that. I really did, you know. So the fact that I have those things today are total gifts, you know. The outside things, the inside things, you know, having some peace of mind today, being able to feel like the person that I am today is the person I'm going to be tomorrow. It's the same person I was yesterday. And I'm not running from all the lies. I'm not running from all the damage I've caused and waiting for it to catch up to me. You know, I can wake up and face my life today with some sort of hope, you know, because I have been taught here that there is some hope. And if I continue to take these steps and try to pass on to another person what I've been given so freely by this program, by you guys, and by my higher power, that I, you know, maybe I'll get to stay here one more day and continue to have this good life. So I am really grateful to be here tonight. I'm grateful to be sober, and thank you for listening.